Hey bitches, it's Bailey. Before we start today's episode, I just wanted to give a quick FYI that the audio on this episode might sound a little bit fuzzier than normal, and that's just because we had a technical difficulty that prevented us from using the software that we normally use, but I can assure you that it's still completely listenable and probably won't even be noticeable to a lot of you, but we just wanted to give you a heads up and apologize because we obviously want to give you the best quality episodes that we can all the time. But we think you're still really going to like this one, so please stick around and enjoy the show. Hello, world, and welcome to Resting Witch Face, your one-stop haunt for all things spooky, bitchy, and more. I'm Bailey Bennett.
I'm Grant Jacoby, and this is your this weekly's helping of just a little bitch.
Just a little bitch. Just like
a little bit of a
it's
bitch.
It's like little bitch, just like we kind of think of them as our children, and like, yeah, they're just like little bitches.
You know? They're not fully grown.
They're on their way. But it's like we can already tell they have like this budding love for death and decay, which like we really want to foster in them. So thank you so much for joining us for that.
Yes, thank you. I also would like to say that it's very ironic that, you know, you're talking about children that are decaying and dying while I'm looking at so many of your thriving plant children.
Oh my God. Wow. Thank you. It has been, you know, the weather's getting warmer. They're doing a lot better, but you are missing. There's a fig upstairs that it had, I want to say like 15 to 20 leaves just yesterday. And then Kyle went to just like open the blinds and barely touched it. And I would say 10 of them fell off.
Really?
Yes.
It's just that dead.
It's gone. She's gone.
I'm
so
sorry for your loss.
It happens.
What was her name?
She didn't have one, and maybe that was the problem.
She didn't have her own identity.
She was actually purchased recently as a replacement for another fig that I killed. So I think, I think the problem is no more fig plants in the house.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe stay away from the figs.
Yeah, so,
and
you know.
And how many are in the room right now? Can you name them for us?
I can tell you what they all are, but here, I'll count them
off
for
you. Some have names, right?
One, two, three. Yeah, that's Scully. She's like my original. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm propagating one over there. I mean, it's truly. Speaking of children, I haven't touched base with you about my Disney trip.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank God.
And by you, I mean everyone on this podcast. And I have to say, nothing about it was really spooky, as usual, because there's nothing about Disney World that's spooky. But I wanted to share
We did that haunt. Did we do, you did
you're
the
right.
Ghost of
there are a lot of people's Disney, ashes scattered in the Haunted Mansion, which we can.
Grandma Joyce.
Oh my God. I didn't even say hi to her. I went on that ride.
Did you really?
Yes, of course. My favorite. The one highlight that I wanted to share with you was our last night there. I was there with my parents and my sister, and we were very tired and just kind of, we were in Epcot and kind of just like looking for a place to sit down and drink, which is harder to find than you would think.
Is it really?
Very difficult. It was very busy. A lot of children. Finally found this pub in the UK pavilion. We were drinking some beers outside, and a girl walked by who was living her best midriff life, and she was on the phone with probably her boyfriend, it sounded like, and she was like, oh my God, babe, like today we went to so many countries. It's like went to like Mexico and like Canada and like Norwegia, and like kept walking, and my entire family was revitalized by the knowledge that someone in this park thought Norwegia was a country. So
good old Norwegia. I want to be like, can you point me to direction of Norwegia?
Excuse me, could you repeat that?
Isn't the Norway ride the one where like it goes like you're in like a little log and it goes backwards?
Yeah, but I hate to tell you, that's Maelstrom. That was the old Norway ride, and it has been replaced by a Frozen ride.
Because, are you kidding me?
No, because Frozen takes place in Norway.
It does.
Yeah, but like it's actually a pretty good ride, and I think they kept the same track because there's a point where you go backwards and it's like a water thing. No, there's different trolls. There's trolls from Frozen.
Nope. I just like to point out the fact that you not only knew what ride I was talking about,
yeah,
But you knew the name of the old ride.
Of course.
Was it Maelstrom?
Maelstrom, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've made clear on this podcast that I'm an absolute freak. And this was my job for a brief period of time when I worked at a travel magazine and wrote about Disney on a daily basis. So
that's very true. So, you know, there's a little excuse.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Little excuse, little bitch.
Yeah. Anyway.
I had to
sneak that in there forcibly.
No, thank God. I love that.
What are we going to be chatting about today?
So this is something I've wanted to talk about for a while, and I was debating. I basically had it on the back burner to do for a full episode for a long time, but I was kind of, the more and more I did research on it, I was kind of like, there actually wasn't as much info out there as I would hope. Beyond like having to do some actual real research, and just
which
no one has time
won't.
For that.
We can't.
So, but then once we started doing these little bitches, I was like, wait, actually, this is like a perfect chance to still do like a nice, I'd say this is like decently in depth without doing a full 45-minute spiel.
Okay, great. I'm excited.
So obviously you and I, as I'm sure many of our listeners, are big fans of My Favorite Murder. We've yes. mentioned it before. And for those of you that have listened to My Favorite Murder, they do, in their minisodes, they take reader submissions of their hometown murders, kind of like how we do reader submissions of, hey, that scared the shit out of me.
Yes.
So where people like write in and they talk about like the murders that happen in their hometown, kind of self-explanatory.
Yes.
So this, bitches and hoes, is my hometown murder.
Oh, yes. Great. Have you told me about this before?
I don't know. So what I will say is the story might sound familiar, partially because I don't know if you've heard it, or because apparently it, according to the book that was written about it called A Murder in Wellesley, The Inside Story of an Ivy League Doctor's Double Life, His
yes.
Slain Wife, and the Trial That Gripped the Nation.
Yes.
Apparently the trial gripped the nation.
It did. I'm gripped.
It's all, but it has very similar odes to The Staircase and to a lot of, Teacher's Pet, like a lot of different other stories, podcasts,
Great.
Series that you've heard of, because this obviously is a pattern in society.
Yeah, which sucks. Does it have to do with the lake? Is there a lake
yeah,
involved?
Oh, there,
okay, then I know the story. Okay, yeah. Great. Let's do this.
So I'm from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It's about 20 to 30 minutes west of Boston. Mm-hmm. Just to paint you a little picture, it is, it's a, you know, college town. It's not like sleepy in the it's kind of sleepy in the sense it's a dry town. There are no bars,
which is honestly shocking. I remember the first time I went there, I was like, I'm sorry, what, you can't buy booze in the entire town? Is that what
but
we're
thank
doing?
God on every single town border there is a liquor store.
Okay, thank God.
Actually, Wellesley is now like a semi-dry town where you can, so let me explain this. So in Wellesley, you can still order booze at a restaurant.
It's okay.
You couldn't just go walk into a restaurant, go up to the bar, sit down, and be like, I would like a Cosmo.
You have to have food
with
it?
You have to get like a calamari
That's
plate too.
So weird.
Isn't that weird?
Okay.
And then I would say probably 2 or 3 years ago, they passed something where you can now get beer and wine in grocery stores.
Wow.
Yeah. Whew. Letting loose.
Incredible.
I blame the Puritans. So
same.
It is, yeah, kind of a small, sleepy town. It's very white, very kind of... It was a great place to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
It was very safe, which is kind of what I'm getting to. It was a very, like, you never really had to worry about, like, walking around at night or anything of that sort. Always very...
Right. It was, like, the worst thing that police had to deal with this year was, like, someone stole a hot dog from a 7-Eleven.
See, we don't have 7-Elevens.
Okay.
No.
I'm so sorry. Okay.
No, but I'll honestly probably be like, Stacy was caught shoplifting from Isabel Harvey, so... That's probably what they're
I probably had hot dogs in 7-Eleven on the mind from last week's episode, so.
True. Oh, yeah. Yes. Anyways, so this story, so I got this information, first and foremost, from my memory. Second of all, from the book A Murder in Wellesley, which was written by
me,
Tom Farmer, who... first reported on the story in the Boston Herald, as well as Marty Foley, who was then a detective with the Massachusetts State Police and one of the lead investigators on the case. But most of this information was compiled into a New York Daily News article from 2012 and a Boston Globe article from 2018.
Awesome.
So let's get into it. So let's go back to Halloween, 1999.
Oh, yes.
How old were you?
I was 7.
I was 8.
Incredible.
Yes. So on the morning of October 31st, 1999, Dr. Dirk Greineder.
No.
Mm-hmm, and his wife, Mabel, who went by May, decided to take a walk. They drove from their home at 56 Cleveland Road in the wealthy Boston suburb of Wellesley. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know where Cleveland Road is.
Okay, cool.
To Morse's Pond, which was a park near the prestigious Women's College, Wellesley College.
Right.
Alma mater of Hillary Clinton, my friend Madeline, and
my friend Madeline.
Lots of other important women.
Right, of course.
The Granders, who had been married for 31 years, parked their van and unloaded Zephyr, who was one of their two German shepherds, out of the car for a leisurely stroll.
These people's names are not real.
I know.
And some animals?
Some white nonsense.
Okay.
So, what happened next has been in some form of dispute for the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Greineder, who was then a respected allergist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, says that he and his wife were walking through the wooded area of the park when she started complaining of a bad back. The details get fuzzy, but he claims he went ahead with the dog, doubling back roughly 10 minutes later. When he returned, Dr. Greineder found his wife lying in the bushes near the path. Her neck was slashed, and her chest was full of puncture wounds, with her pants pulled down around her ankles in a staged sexualized position.
Oh, honey.
Just to really add some insult to injury.
So his story was his wife was complaining that he was in pain, so he left her alone?
Yeah, so
she was, like, sitting at a bench or something?
His story changes. Okay. But the initial claim is that she was like, oh, my back hurts. Mm. I'm going to take a seat. Like, you keep going with the dog.
Got it.
And he was like, don't worry, honey. I'll be right back. Like,
sure, that's very clear. Okay.
Yeah. So he finds her body. He says he then checked her vitals, ran back to his car where his cell phone was charging, because this is the 90s, and to call for help, and then returned to the side of his already dead wife, his very clearly mutilated body of his wife.
Oh, God. Okay.
So once the police arrived, and as Greineder began to tell his story, he very clearly insisted that an unknown assailant must have killed May, which is a statement he still maintains to this day.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Okay. However, this is not what police would determine, nor what prosecutors would eventually argue before a jury. First of all, Greineder made inconsistent statements at the crime scene about the discovery of his wife's body. So he first told paramedics that, in quote, his wife twisted her back, throwing a ball to the dog. She stopped walking, and the defendant went ahead to retrieve the dog. After putting the dog in the van, he returned and found his wife lying in the path. So mm-hmm. it was the first version. Okay. So she was throwing it. Mm-hmm. He then went to go get the ball, bring the dog, and came back for her.
Sure.
However, later he told the police, that his wife tripped on something, injuring her back. She told him to go on without him, and she would meet him at the entrance to the parking area. When he and the dog reached the gate to the beach, the dog started acting funny, and it turned back. He then followed and discovered his wife lying in the path.
Mm-hmm. Just reeks of bullshit.
Yeah.
It's just, like, the thinnest.
Yeah, it's like, if you're going to come up with some sort of story, mm-hmm. maybe stick to it,
stick
or at least have it be something. I guess, like, I could understand if she was like, ow, like, I twisted something. I'm just gonna sit here for a second. Like, the dog ran away.
Sure.
Go get the dog. I'll meet up with you.
Yeah.
But just the facts just don't feel quite right. His bizarre statements continued. When about 20 minutes after talking to the police officer at the scene of the crime, he asked if his wife was dead. So he's already telling the story for 20 minutes before he's like, oh, by the way, is she dead?
Oh, God.
And the police officer's like, duh. And it took only 5 minutes later, after hearing his wife was dead, for him to then ask the officer if he was going to be arrested.
No.
Which is, like, probably, I mean, it's been said before, I'll say it again, we all deal with grief in different ways.
Right.
You know, you could be in shock, blah, 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 blah. But if your first instinct isn't to be asking about your dead wife, mm-hmm. or if your wife is dead, but more importantly, will I be arrested? That's not a great sign.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I've definitely also heard that, like, your first instinct is to it's like to be in denial about the fact that they're dead and to like talk about them in like the present tense as if they're still around. And like, you're not like, your mind doesn't immediately switch to being like, oh, is she dead? Okay. Oh, she's dead. So am I going to get arrested? Yeah. Like that's, it's just, there's a longer period of denial first.
Exactly. And there's just a clear sign of premeditated thinking, like overshooting that.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of the first sign, like something was off. Second, a pair of work gloves and a knife were recovered nearby the scene that matched those that Grinder apparently used at his home, and also his DNA was found on them.
Okay. Well,
the defense stated that the test results also indicated the presence of DNA from a stranger, and that Grinder's DNA could have been transferred to the various items from a casual exchange between him and his wife.
What?
So I think their very, very flimsy argument was like, oh, it could have been his, but like someone else used them to kill him, kill her.
Okay. Okay.
furthermore, this is the wildest part to me.
Okay.
So furthermore, the blood spatter patterns on Grinder's clothes were
on the wife's clothes.
The wife's clothes. Yeah, okay. No, sorry, on his clothes. So he's covered in her blood.
Oh.
The patterns on his clothes do not match the story that he's telling, like, because he's covered in her blood.
Why would he be covered in her blood? Just because he went over to check her vitals?
Well,
and he laid his whole body on top.
Well, so that, but then it's also the fact that he claimed that he took his wife's pulse.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, why would a successfully trained doctor take the pulse of a victim whose throat had been cut nearly to the bone and was clearly deceased?
Uh-huh.
Like, I can understand some sort of denial, you're in shock, but is that your first instinct?
I can even see you like shaking her shoulders or like calling her name and like some kind of like not really knowing what's happening, like trying to get her to wake up. But if your first thought is like, let me just quickly check that wrist. Oh, no, yeah. I'm not getting anything.
Well, you sure wasn't checking her neck pulse because her head was almost gone.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't know if that's true. I don't want to sensationalize too much. There are certain things that I definitely kind of peppered in here that I was like, I remember hearing about this because in high school, I've read the book, Murder in Wellesley.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in high school, I can't remember if it was the specific detective, but they did like a seminar at my school, like about the case.
Oh, wow.
Which probably was like rather inappropriate for a bunch of maybe high schoolers.
I think if it's your hometown, you get to embellish a little bit. Sorry, everyone.
So back to her neck wound, which was in quote, was large, 5.5 inches long and 2.5 inches wide.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Caused either by two thrusts with a knife or movement by the victim during a single thrust. Oh, I see. So either it was two jabs to the neck or one stab and then she moved, which is really, really horrible.
Oh, yeah.
So she's got this gaping neck wound and he's covered in her blood, except there was no blood on his hands.
Okay.
So you're in a panic. Mm-hmm. You're checking your wife's pulse of who's clearly dead.
Yep.
You're covered in her blood.
Mm-hmm.
How does it not get on your hands?
Yeah.
What would be the only reason?
Mm-hmm. Maybe you washed them.
Or you were wearing gloves.
That's true too. Wow, Nancy Drew over here.
Well, they were by a pond, so he could have done a little ASMR.
Right, thank you.
But his hands were presumably clean.
That makes sense.
Also, I just think that sight in general, just like that picture in my mind of this guy standing there covered in blood except his hands, like, it's just like such a, just like bone chilling.
Why would he be covered in blood at all?
Because he claims that he was like, I think he claimed that he was like,
oh, but there's nothing on his hands. Okay, great.
Again, makes no sense.
Okay, perfect.
The blood was there from blood splatter.
Yes.
So, even more incriminating was the subsequent, as if this all wasn't already enough. Like, this is like the clearest open and shut case. Even more incriminating was the subsequent discovery that the good doctor had a history of soliciting sex workers and reveling in hardcore internet porn.
Wow, fuck this guy.
Yeah, the classic. This is where we're like really coming around to the staircase situation. Heterosexual, but nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors at his 2001 trial claimed that May had allegedly discovered her husband's stash of Viagra and was on the verge of uncovering his entire sordid sex life, which is why he supposedly felt compelled to kill her. first striking her on the head with a hammer and then brutally stabbing her to death.
Oh, God.
Though Grinder's lawyers have generally maintained that his sex life was extraneous to the case at hand, it was not enough for the jury to disregard. The prosecution alleged that he used the gloves during the murder, then tried to dispose of them unsuccessfully, and that Grinder's clean hands were not consistent with the life-saving effort the doctor had described. Duh.
Right.
That cleanliness specifically actually in the end was kind of the smoking gun, and Dr. Grinder was found guilty of the first degree murder of his wife.
Great.
Great.
I mean, not great for her. This is so tragic for her.
So it's just worth noting that A Murder in Wellesley, the book itself, makes Grinder out to be, you know, a pervert and a liar, one who's concerned about more about his dogs than his dead wife. Oh, I remember actually that in the book. There's something where he was, like, more concerned about the well-being of the dog as the police were there than, like, the fact that his wife's corpse was, like, a stone's throw.
Amazing.
He was given to rambling statements about his own innocence before he'd been charged with anything. And he was also, they obviously discovered this later, that he was known to send naked pictures of himself to potential threesome prospects.
Oh.
What kind of threesomes? I don't know.
Fun. Okay.
However, it's worth being note, well, according to, and I actually do remember from reading the book, that the book has received criticism for the aggressive, heroic descriptions of the police as if they handled the investigation perfectly and justly. So it's very much, because one of the authors or the contributing authors is a police officer who was on the case, it's very like, ooh,
okay,
we did such a good job. Yeah. He was such a fucking creep, which, yeah. I mean, he was. But yeah. Belinda Markle, the daughter of May Grinder's sister, so the niece, but on the May's side, contributes to the book also saying that Grinder was at best callous and at worst insane. In these pages, she notes how he referred to his dead wife as, quote, the body.
Oh, God.
Not a good sign.
No.
And after the funeral, which was portrayed as being done very cheaply, he apparently greeted mourners in a good mood that was described as unusually jovial, even frivolous, almost boisterous, at one point joking around with his Yale swimming coach.
How fucking creepy would that be?
Again, like, I,
yeah.
Yeah, you never know. And right. There have been times when I've seen people, like, in deep stages of grief when they are kind of in, like, it's more like a calm mood that I think is kind of, in my experience, more typical, where you find this, either it's a weird sense of euphoria or kind of this, like, bizarre, like, oh my God, like, I don't know what's happening. Like,
right.
And especially, you know, I feel like also at funerals, the family has to almost, like, take care of everyone. I mean, if you think of, you know, like Catholic wakes where like you like go down the line and you're paying your respects, but it's almost this weird obligation for the family to take on the mourner's pain as opposed, I feel like it should be the other way around, which is always why sitting shivas made more sense to me. I'm not Jewish. This is irrelevant. Although among those, however, who have never believed that Grinder was guilty are, you guessed it.
I didn't guess it.
His children.
Okay, great. I'm doing really well on this one.
I didn't really.
I actually don't even remember you saying they had kids.
I didn't.
Okay, so it was a three question.
So he has three adult children: Kristen, Britt, and Colin. Like their father, all three are Yale graduates. Kristen and Colin are also doctors. Kristen said that, in quote, "My father did not commit this crime. My father did not kill my mother," which he stated under oath during his trial from the witness stand.
Okay.
Which, again, this kind of circles back to the staircase, where it's like this weird, I mean, I don't know if it's a coping mechanism where it's like you can't believe that your one parent is dead, let alone that the other parent has done it.
It's too much to lose them both at once, I feel.
But I don't know. I hope that no one that listening to this episode ever has to deal with that.
Right.
But I just think that at a certain point you would have to face... Yeah. Real. And I'm pretty sure to this day they like still stand by him, which at a certain point I think you'd have to be like,
especially in a case like this where you're like, it's pretty cut and dry. It's at least with the staircase, I feel like there's a little bit more ambiguity. Like I can see how you could be on his side, but
because the staircase murder doesn't make, like, no matter where you cut it, it doesn't make sense. Whereas this is like, like it's pretty laid out there.
Right.
It's funny. My mom said that. Because, I mean, obviously, I remember when this happened, probably more like a couple years later, I remember hearing about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas my mom said that, like, because it happened on Halloween, she said that, you know, all of her friends were, like freaking out. And they're like, oh, my God, like, like, should we take the kids out trick-or-treating tonight? Like, is this, because this was like, this was crazy.
Oh
like,
my God, I'm
this
sure.
This doesn't, like, this just doesn't happen in Wellesley. There's, right. I don't think there'd been a murder before. I don't think there has been one since. Mm-hmm. I'm probably wrong, but my mom said that, like, all her friends were freaking out. She was like, oh, the husband did it. Like, she's like, even like that first day, she was like, of course not. Like, we're fine.
Yeah.
So Alexander Nazarian of the New York Daily News makes the case that that what never really becomes clear from the book, Murder in Wellesley, or even the trial, is to why Grindr would kill his wife, even if, as was alleged, she discovered the stash of self-prescribed Viagra and was on the cusp of finding out about his trysts with sex workers and predilection for porn. After all, some men cheat, and many look at porn. Everyone looks at porn.
Right.
Of these, plenty are discovered by their spouses, but very few, almost none, statistically resort to murder.
Right.
But
also, like, I mean, if you're already, like, unhinged, I could see how you would jump to the conclusion that you had to do that.
Farmer and Foley, who wrote the book Murder in Wellesley, throughout the course of the book, stay very on the surface of the case, over almost never mentioning the motive, which leaves the reader wondering if they ever came up with a good one. This is the, I'm not saying this as my claim. It's just kind of like a point that was made that I was thought worth bringing up, which I do understand that when there isn't a motive, it definitely leaves some questions unanswered. Like, I feel like this particular motive, I get it. It doesn't really make sense, but at the same time, it's like, it's very clear that he wanted to kill his wife. Maybe it was that he was like, I really don't want to get divorced, but I don't want to be married to her anymore. I want to just go out and fuck whoever I want.
Right.
Or maybe, you know, she found out about his affairs and she was going to leave him and she was going to take all his money. And he was like, you never know. It could have been for insurance money. Like, there's plenty of reasons.
Of course. People have killed for less.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's the truth.
I just think that there is, I guess, a more kind of introducing the narrative that's out there where it's kind of like, oh, the book was very skewed and very biased. So and there's no real doubt that he did it or not. It's more kind of like, how was it handled? Was it handled the best?
Right.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. However, as of October 2018, nearly 20 years after the murder, U.S. Magistrate Judge Judith Gale Dean recommended that Grindr's petition for a writ of habeas corpus, which is a legal mechanism for challenging the validity of convictions and sentencing, be rejected. So basically, as of this past fall, he was trying to appeal to get a new trial.
And they were like, nah.
But they were like, nah, sorry, there's still enough. Like,
I'm still pretty sure.
Yeah, pretty sure you did it, and pretty sure that you would get convicted again. So let's not waste the court's time.
Yeah.
There's more information, I'm sure, out there about the case. I suggest, if you're interested, to pick up A Murder in Wellesley. It's a decent book. Mm-hmm. I will say, in my humble opinion, it's very fact-based. Mm-hmm. So it's very like, and then we walked to the car, and then we saw him coming up to us from the woods. Mm. He came to the car. We asked, it's very like matter of fact. Okay. It's not prose. It's not like reading I'll Be Gone in the Dark, where you're like, oh my God, I'm reading a true crime. It feels like a novel. It's very like, but it's a case that's always fascinated me, partially because it happened like in my town during my time of life. I just wanted to share that story. I always wanted to submit it to My Favorite Murder for Hometown Murder. Someone then did, and they read it, and they did a horrible job of telling it. Not Karen in Georgia. Like, whoever wrote in didn't really do an amazing job of.
Wow, rude.
Super rude.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it here. I loved that. I mean, it's a very sad story, and
it is. And I'm
sure it shook your town to the core for good reason.
It did.
Great. Well, great. I mean, That's our little bitch.
I think that's our little bitch.
I really liked that. If you guys have your own, I mean, not to do what My Favorite Murder does, but if you guys have a hometown murder you want to share, we'd love to hear it. But we'd also love to hear any spooky, scary shit that's happened to you. For our "Hey, That Scared the Shit Out of Me" segments.
I would say, if you're going to submit a hometown murder, I want it to be like, oh, I moved into the house of where the murder took place.
I want, or there,
like,
to be a ghost
involved. I want, like, oh, or at least like it happened where, like, you can, like, talk about what it actually was like.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's something that's like very, oh my God, I don't want to shit on viewer submissions, but there's something very unsatisfying when you hear someone tell a story about like, oh, like back in the 20s, like this like farmer, he like shot his daughter and it was crazy. And you're like, okay, yeah, that happens everywhere.
Right. No, we love hearing your personal experiences.
Yes.
But again, like we're here to listen. We're here to listen. So email us at rwfpodcast@gmail.com. You can DM us on Instagram at rwfpodcast. We're also on Twitter. I don't know. You're not going to tweet it to us, but you know, you can follow us
on Twitter.
You can DM us on Twitter. Of course you can. I work in social media. Thank you so much for listening as always. And we'll see you guys. We won't see you, but we'll
you'll hear us
next week.
You sure will.
Bye, bitches.